It's very lovely to see everyone again. Lots of familiar faces. I saw you, many of you, at the retreat that we had at Wellspring. And there's a warm glow lingering from that occasion. I think the last time I came here, there was this was the archetypal dark and stormy night, and the rain lashing on the windows and pitch dark. Hard to imagine. Blue skies over Casper. I brought my woollen pullover, especially. But I know what it's like in August on the coast. They can't fool me. But life is full of surprises. So I was just reflecting on what to talk about this evening. There's always a thousand possible subjects. But I thought I might begin by talking a little bit about the subject of desire, which has a very central place in the Buddhist world. It's a much spoken of commodity. And basically, desire gets what's referred to on this continent as a, or technically referred to as a bum rap. That desire is sort of represented as the big nasty, and that this is all completely wrong and bad, and that the whole point of Buddhism is to stop desiring anything. And when you stop desiring anything, then you've arrived. And this is the way it often gets represented. And and people are puzzled by this. You know, we think, well, is all desire bad? Sure, are there some good desires, or how can that be? But then you look at the teachings, and it's right there in the Four Noble Truths that desire is the cause of dukkha, of suffering, of unsatisfactoriness. And so it's like, you know, top center, there it is. It's like, well, how does this work? And what does this mean? And so I think it's helpful, and why I thought I might talk about it. We've been having readings from an anthology of Buddhist teachings at the monastery, and this came up a week or two ago, and it just sprang to mind to talk about this evening, because it is heavily misunderstood, and it's a lot to do with language, because in English, you know, the word desire has a very broad range of meanings, and so we just use the one word for many, many different qualities of life, or qualities of mind. Some of which are useful, some of which are not useful, but they all get lumped under the single heading of desire. And so then, if we read a sentence like, you know, desire is the cause of all suffering, then it's like, oh, how do we handle that? So, and then oftentimes when people take hold of that and think, well, I'm supposed to be desireless, therefore trying to, well, I really value Buddhism, and I think this is the greatest thing, and it really means a lot to me, and so I'll try and be completely desireless. So then any kind of thought that comes into your mind like, oh, you know, I feel hungry, it's a desire. You're doing it again. Even though you just woken up in the morning and you haven't eaten for 8 hours and your stomach's rumbling, and you think, oh, I really fancy a bowl of cereal. There he goes again. Corrupt, passion-filled. Every day it's the same. Aren't you ever going to get over this? Don't you know desire is the cause of all suffering? You know, you should. If you really had your practice together, you wouldn't feel interested in breakfast. There's an old Zen saying, I'm sure, maybe it was an old Zen saying that was written in Berkeley, but it was represented to me as an old Zen saying, which says, all day and all night I hunger for truth, in the morning I hunger for breakfast. Yes, the sage is profound. And there is actually a lot of wisdom encased in that. Because the word, I don't want to get too much into Pali semantics, but there's a useful thing to understand, that when the word that the Buddha used for desire in talking about the cause of suffering or dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, that optional painfulness of life, is the word tanha. And tanha literally means thirst or craving. And in the usage of the word, just like the word craving, there's an intrinsically destructive or chaotic or disturbed quality that the word has. So it's impossible. There's nowhere in the Pali scriptures, in the Buddhist teachings, where it said, you know, this person has tanha for enlightenment, or has the tanha to do good, or the tanha to develop develop concentration and peacefulness of mind. You can't put the two words together. They don't match. They have no meaning together. Like even in a kind of an extreme statement, you just would never use those words together. Like saying, you know, it's a really green 5 o'clock today. Say, huh? That doesn't mean anything. Or, yeah, what an extraordinarily salty morning. You know, like, huh? The words just don't belong together, unless in some kind of poem. But they have no intrinsic relatedness at all. So. The Buddha points to that one particular quality, tanha, as being what causes us to create difficulty and struggle and alienation within our life. And so that word tanha is specifically a kind of disturbed, self-centered, compulsive attraction towards an object, or aversion towards an object. There are different kinds of, tanha can be generated in different ways. You can be, you can crave to get a hold of something. You can crave to become something. You can crave to get rid of something. There are different kinds of it, but all of them have this connotation of profound disturbance, and they're very much based around self-centeredness. You know, there's a very powerful presence of me in the middle of that. The sense of I and what I want, and what I can't stand, and what I gotta have, and what I'm going to be, and which carries with it a blindness, an intrinsic sense of blindness, insensitivity to the people and things around us. So that's a very, very different energy than what we would say is, like, you know, the desire for the desire to help someone, or the desire to let your mind be free from anger or greed, the desire to awaken, the desire to calm down. You know, we can use the same word in English, but in the Buddhist languages, they would never use tanha for that. They would use words that imply intention or aspiration. Or zeal. So, and in fact, rather than thinking that the Buddhist path is developing a completely desireless life, you know, and sometimes this does get put across in the book, where in Buddhist literature, where the idea of desirelessness, you know, you get the impression that you're supposed to turn yourself into a completely sort of zombified individual, that is sort of utterly neutral, a neutralized human being, where you just sort of are. I don't do, I am. And then unless you're sort of moved around, kind of, and anything is sort of, unless you're kind of shoved and picked up and directed at things, then you just sort of hover there and exist. Which is kind of obscene, you know, we laugh because it's kind of absurd. But oftentimes that desirelessness is represented in that way, that you have no kind of act of volition or choice or direction of energy in any way. And so we turn the idea of kind of passivity, being kind of completely passive, we interpret the idea of peacefulness or desirelessness or perfection with this kind of you know, a human life with the plug pulled out, you know, just like no engagement, and that you're not supposed to involve yourself with anything. You never get kind of say engaged with particular projects. You avoid people, you avoid activity, you avoid responsibility, you certainly avoid making waves in the world, you know, and that kind of quietism, what they call quietism, kind of taking yourself away and putting yourself in a mode of life where you think you won't create any disturbance at all. But the teaching of the Buddha is actually very far from that. It doesn't speak in those terms at all. And that if you look, the Buddha is a great list maker. I've propounded this theory before. I'm sure he was a Virgo. I've got severe Virgo and tendencies of list making, and I'm a Virgo myself, so I know I have. As long as I've got a list, I feel fine. Then the world is. I can have as many things on the list as I like, but if I haven't got a list, I get all kind of anxious. And then if I've got it all labeled and numbered, then it's right. Okay, now I've got the universe covered. So the Buddha was a great list maker. And the in the lists of things that are required for enlightenment, there's many of these lists, kind of seven of them in particular, seven lists. And of them, in these seven lists, the factors of energy, of intention, of zealousness, of directing our power as a human being appears in every single one. But in every single one of these lists of what you need in order to arrive or to perfect a human life, the application and the direction and the refinement of energy and intentionality is there. It's over and over and over and over again. So it's not like it's a side issue. Actually, that quality of arousing ourselves and directing the power and the energy of our life towards what is wholesome, what is noble, what's liberating, is a crucial element to what we're trying to do with Buddhist practice. And this is a very different quality to tanha, because rather than craving and having that disturbed quality, what the Buddha's teachings point us to is the arousing of energy and directing our attention and directing our intentions based upon selflessness, based upon wisdom, based upon sensitivity to the people and the things around us. So that energy and that kind of goal-directedness, if you like, is certainly kind of pointed at particular objects, but it's not obsessed. It's not devoid of a connectedness and an attunement to the things around us. So this is really crucial. You know, there's one particular list. That's called the basis of success, and or the Idipada, the basis of success or the basis of power, and the first two of these, Chanda and Virya, you know, really outline this. Like, if you want to succeed at anything, whether it's frying an egg or attaining enlightenment or driving a car, that and you know, the Buddha points this out in great detail. This is whether it's a worldly goal or a transcendent goal. You know, you're not going to succeed in anything that you do unless you have these qualities. Chanda means interest or zeal. It actually means desire. Like, you've got to be interested, and you've got to kind of be excited about it. You've got to say, this is important. Here's a place to put my mind. Yes. It's the saying of yes and putting our attention on something. And then, you know, this is important, this is interesting, you know, lock onto it. Chanda, like a Dhamma Chanda, is like the kind of the zeal for Dhamma or truth. Karma Chanda is the zeal for sense pleasure. So that's like sense desire is Karma Chanda. Dhamma Chanda is the zeal or the excitement or the attractiveness of truth, of Dhamma. And then the second one of these is Virya, energy. So it's like you've got to be interested, and then you've got to apply energy. If you want to fry an egg, you've got to want to fry an egg first, right? I mean, you don't just sort of drift around the kitchen and then kind of happen to run into an egg and then find your hands kind of moving and going for the frying pan. It just doesn't go that way. It's just, you know, there's that rumble, and then you say, aha, breakfast, fry egg. Find muesli, etc. And then that, out of that interest, then it's energy. You can't just say, yeah, right, I'd really like an egg for breakfast, and then and then there's the interest, and there's the wanting, and they say, yeah, well, this is a human body and I feel hunger, and yeah, if you put food into it, it stays alive, and that's a kind of good thing. And if you don't apply the energy, it doesn't happen, right? It's fairly obvious. So that there's that, you've got to be interested, you've got to apply energy. And then the third of these factors, citta. Citta means mind or heart. Also means to think about something, which means you've got to think about how you're going to do it. Like, how do I do this thing? Which end do I open first? How do I get into this packet of muesli? Or how do I start the car? And you have to remember how it's done, use your intellectual knowledge, think about what you're doing. And then the fourth of these, which is also very helpful, with any kind of action, any kind of work that we're doing, you'll notice that all of these, you know, the early ones are kind of very motivating, kind of direction, goal-oriented, like pointing the mind at things. And it's very easy for us in this kind of, particularly in the American culture, as like a go-get attitude, you kind of go for it. But we don't often look back and see the results of our having gone for it, because we're so busy going for the next thing, you know. And we kind of either had a good time out of the last thing we went for, or not such a good time. But the what we find ourselves in the kind of compulsive and consumer sort of materialistic culture in the West is that even in spiritual domains, once we've gone for it, we just go for the next one. And the next one, and the next, and the next. And so this last quality is the quality of reviewing, called vimamsa in Pali. So that means, like, when you've put your energy into doing something, so this is a good thing to do, I need to drive the car, I need to get to Fort Bragg, or I need to make the breakfast, or I need to learn how to meditate. I'm trying to practice a meditation technique. So you're interested in it, you apply the effort to it, you think about how to do it, you consider the right ways and the best ways to do it. And then reviewing means to look back at the results of what you've done. Like, how did that work out? What was the results of my effort? Okay, I applied myself, but is application always right? Just because I'm kind of energetic about something, does that make it good? And so... Just because I'm excited about it, does it make it work? Not always, right? So that quality of, like, when we've applied ourselves, we've kind of followed our desire with a wholesome intention and say, okay, this is a good thing to do, I want to help this person, I want to follow through this action, and then okay, you did that, and that's, you know, you followed this through, you did this act to help this person, you know, you, but then even though you did it with the best of intentions, or you tried this or you tried that, how did it work out? What was the result of it? And so it's like turning your attention back and then really learning from the successes or the failures of what we do. And then rather than just, you know, and what's contained within that, like reviewing in that way, again, it's not this kind of blandness that sometimes the Buddhist teachings get represented with. It's all okay. You know? I tried to do it right, but it was a complete mess up. You know, I boiled the cheese. The egg went on the floor. You know, or driving your car, you kind of smash into two people when you're trying to park outside the general store, or practicing meditation. Say, well, you know, I could see it's a really good idea to practice meditation. I see, you know, like all these people on retreats, and they you know, sit there without moving for an hour. So I decided to do that, and I said, okay, I won't move for the next hour, and we'll have to go for knee surgery next week. And they say I might be able to walk normally again, but it's not for certain. But as soon as I'm out of hospital, I'll kind of get back on the cushion again. What reviewing the monks is about is like we're learning the result, the beneficial or the painful results of what we do, so that we can direct our energy better in the future. If we have this kind of bland attitude of, oh well, it's all right, I kind of wrecked myself, or I kind of messed it all up, or in the same way, you know, we do something that is incredibly helpful to somebody else. Someone comes up to us and says, oh, that was so kind, you know, I was ill, and that note from you, you know, was so thoughtful, and it was really made the whole difference, and I felt I could, all this energy came back, and I felt so happy, and, you know, I realized that people do love me, and I feel great, and it's, you know, and I just wanted to thank you and say how much you mean to me. And you say, well, you know, it's all empty, and doesn't really mean anything anyway, does it, you know? After all, it's just it wasn't really, you know, all dharmas are not self, and it wasn't really me who wrote the card anyway, you know, so none of it matters. And so, you know, you don't acknowledge the goodness, the rightness of your actions either. You're kind of going at it with a sort of emptiness card, you know, the emptiness joker. So, well, it's all empty, nothing of it matters, and so kind of falsely or desensitizing ourselves to, you know, to the way life is. Whereas this approach and the way that the Buddha's teaching directs us to is saying, yeah, it makes a difference. You know, if you get the muesli in the bowl, it's a lot better than getting it all over the floor, right? If you want to eat, you get less of a mess. If you, you know, that you actually, the way that you are, actually can help people. People are really benefited by your kindness, or people are really hurt. It's real hurt if you say something cruel, or you just ignore someone in a deliberate way. That hurts, that's real pain. It makes a difference. And so that where we direct our energy and how we direct our energy makes a difference. And so that's why, you know, the whole quality of arousing energy to get something, get anything done in the first place, and then directing energy and seeing how what the results of our directing are, how we direct our energy, seeing how that works is crucial to our whole development as a human being. Because if we don't do that, you know, if we don't understand that that's a kind of central issue, then we fail to fulfill a lot of the potential that we have, or we take kind of we think that we're following kind of great spiritual principles, but actually in our effort to or picking up the principles in the wrong way, we kind of are overriding our common sense a lot of the time, and then kind of life keeps rebounding on us. You know, we keep kind of making mistakes and not learning from them, and not really making the full use of the abilities and possibilities that we have. So then the trick is to learn how to, you know, arouse energy, direct energy, and put energy into things and into what's wholesome and not what is compulsive. So with the meditation practice, this is something that we can begin to see and actually detect the kind of the difference between when we're working at something. There's a real qualitative difference to the feel when we're in a compulsive state, you know, the kind of white knuckle compulsiveness of being focused on something, and when we're applying energy, a lot of energy and a lot of direction, but there's no compulsiveness there. And those things are very, very different. There's a whole different feel, and with the meditation practice we can actually develop a feel for that, just like you can develop a feel for a note which is on pitch, or a line which is just at the right shape in a picture, or when the carrots are just done. You know, that's it, that's the moment, that's the shape, that's the note. Right. And developing that sensitivity with our own qualities of being is an art form that we can learn and is incredibly useful to us. Now, there's different ways that we can approach this. One of which is, when you're in a compulsive state and you find that you are obsessing on something, and that you realize, that you haven't unclenched your teeth for the last 20 minutes. Well, you think, what's that pain in my cheek? And you realize you just clamped half of your jaw between your teeth. And so it's getting separated. The blood's coming into your mouth. And or that, your gut is tightened, or your hands are clenched, or whatever. Or your neck is in a vice. And so that then to recognize that state, and rather than thinking, oh God, I'm getting carried away, I'm getting compulsive about this again, to actually, rather than immediately try and stop it, sustain the compulsion, keep it going, but keep it going with a full awareness. So like, okay, let's kind of get the lights on here, shall we? And so we're going to turn the lights up and see what's actually happening here, and then feel what that is like in the body when we're kind of so focused on fixing this engine or finishing this article or whatever it might be that we insert your favorite obsession here, .. your compulsion of the week. And then as you feel that and you recognize that energy, just then stay with it and like really get to know it. And like feel what's the sensations of it in the body. How do you feel it in your hands, in your gut, in your neck, in your face, in your jaw? You know, what is there with that? And then similarly, what you find is that as you kind of look at the body, and this is like reviewing the results of what you've done, like this is the Vimamsa action, you're actually kind of looking back at, okay, this is the results of that mental state. And you go, wow, this feels bad. This is really horrible. God, my guts have got a knot in it, and my heart's pounding. I'm, afraid someone's going to walk in and find me like this. Yeah, but 5 minutes ago I was just right there. And you actually see the state that you're making yourself in. God, this is terrible. Now, rather than going into a kind of guilt trip or self-criticism at that point, though, just to stay with that feeling of like a recognition of that, this is a really ugly feeling, this is a really ugly state, and just let that be cognized, let that sink in, and then our own heart will start to incline away from that. I mean, we'll still get obsessed about other things in the future, but slowly, the more we do that, then the more that the heart says, I really just don't want to participate in this. Why do I do this to myself? And rather like, you know, giving up burning your fingers or kind of hurting yourself in some way, like a drinking habit or tearing your fingernails off or forming disastrous relationships or sitting on meditation retreats. Unnecessary inducement of pain and kind of that we can create for ourselves just throughout the kind of habituation, just seeing like, why do I do this to myself, and just listening to that voice and just letting the recognition of that painfulness just allow us to kind of drop it and move away. Another way of developing this is kind of on the other angle, is to learn how to exercise energy and action from a peaceful place. This is quite common within the forest monastic tradition of Thailand. That people talk about, you were meditating in the forest in Thailand for years, and So I spent 2 years in the forest in Thailand, and immediately you can see the picture forming in their mind, like under the tree, hour after hour, day after day, the leaves fall down, the monsoon comes. And so that's what, he was in the forest in Thailand, and it's like that's all you see, but actually there's particularly within the Thai tradition and also the ancient Indian tradition, that the meditative monastic life is an extremely dynamic one. That there's a lot of action that goes on. We do all the kind of building work around the monastery is all done by the monks and nuns of the community. All the building and maintenance, and we kind of make all our own robes and. And then we travel quite a lot, kind of going wandering on foot. And the whole style of life is not one of particularly trying to kind of freeze the human condition, like, be as physically still or as controlled, day and night as possible, but much more developing mindfulness and developing mindfulness of stillness and mindfulness of action. And there's one particular very well-known forest monastery and teacher, Ajahn Mahabua, and the kind of monastery motto is be fast, be silent, be mindful. And like, I have never been to this monastery, but people always say it's like everyone just runs, it's apparently the same in Aihaji monastery in Japan, like everyone just runs, it's time to do the chores, it's like who gets down to the end of the Dharma hall fastest with the dusters, across the floor. And when the monks go out on their alms round in the morning around the villages, with the alms bowls to receive the food offerings, it's like, they say that you have to walk in a very composed manner when you're walking through the village, but like as soon as you get to the edge of the village, like you absolutely must not be the last monk back to the monastery, like completely verboten. And so that they just kind of hurtle, down these kind of country lanes, getting back to the monastery, Only the abbot has to be the one, the last one. And he walks pretty briskly and everyone kind of races back. But it's a kind of style that's developed. Out of a recognition of, the fact that we can apply energy with a completely peaceful mind, that we can be completely still and apply for the body and the mind also to be engaging with a great deal of action, complexity and engagement without our being obsessed by it, without being carried away, without that compulsion. And when we were doing the retreat at Wellspring, as probably some of you remember, I know it was at least 3.5 years ago now, but you know, I was talking about using the walking meditation in that way. I think I was. I usually do. But learning to observe the body moving with the, from the still mind. So the mind is still, but the body moves. And so that kind of development of being able to take action and to say perceive the body moving, or you know, engaging with other people, talking, moving around, doing things, driving your car. You're actually physically still when you drive your car, right? You're hardly moving at all. You're just still. And then there's a sensation of movement. And if you switch it around, it's kind of interesting, maybe slightly dangerous thing to do, but you can switch it around so that you're actually perfectly still and you just have this image of the road flowing into your eyes. It's easier it's probably safer if you're a passenger to do this, but it's an interesting exercise to do, because you can actually switch it around and see that the car, the vehicle is absolutely still, and you just got this kind of 3D movie happening. If you close one eye, it works better. Because it's like, you haven't got the 3D effect. But it's quite amazing, because you can see that actually all that's happening is the arising of sight, sound, feeling, coming and going. There's a picture changing, it comes and goes, it changes. And that which knows the moving pictures and the feelings and sounds that come and go, that is completely still, it's completely silent, it's unmoving. And that's the fact, just at this very moment. You know, that which knows your body, that which knows the sound of this voice, is actually perfectly still, it's perfectly silent. Your awareness is silent. That awareness knows the feelings of the body. When I move my hand, the hand is moving, but the mind which knows it isn't moving. It doesn't belong to the world of time and space. So that finding that place of stillness from which we can act, then actually we find that there's a tremendous source of energy, and that rather than being afraid of doing anything, rather than being afraid of taking action in the world or feeling that, you know, that being goal-directed means that we're full of desire, that the more that we cultivate wisdom and kindness and a sensitivity to others, then what happens is that we find ourselves free to take action when action is needed, and the action happens. And it's goal-directed. Yeah, I want to help this person. I want to do this thing. This is a useful project, and that energy flows forth because it's kind of elicited by the situation in which you're acting. It's drawn forth by the needs of the people around you, or the dictates of the situation. Something needs to be done. We need to get this roof on before the rains come, and then suddenly, or get this barn up, get this meditation hall, you know, into place, and so. Suddenly all the energy is there because the situation draws it forth. And that can be, something which is entirely wholesome in nature. It's not like, you know, Cindy's having doubts about, well, I'm, you know, is me wanting to build this meditation hall just kind of, am I desiring this meditation hall? Is it something that I want? And yet, you know, if the motivation is, well, this is a good thing, and it's not kind of obsessive, and it's coming from a place of kindness and wisdom and sensitivity, then that there can be all the kind of focus and direction and push in the world, but that doesn't have to be compulsive. And if we can use the meditation again to find how we can act with high energy, from a place of stillness, then it's very helpful to know that place. Very important to know that place. So it's particularly like doing walking meditation in the winter is really good for this, because it's so cold that you find, like, and we usually have our retreats in the winter time, so particularly in England or at Abhayagiri, and you know, on the clear nights, like in January and February, it can get down to like 15 degrees, maybe 20 degrees, it's chilly. Mm-hmm. And you find that, and you're doing the walking meditation like before dawn, waiting for breakfast. And you find that this incredible vigor starts to come into your steps as you go. The kind of walking meditation gets very, very brisk. Or it's not very windy. Abhayagiri isn't a windy place, but Amravati is like on a hilltop in England, and the English winters are really can be really nasty. You know, they're not only cold, but they're also wet at the same time. And so again, we do the walking meditation early in the morning. You have about two or three layers of robes around you, two or three layers of hats. And you're doing the walking meditation. You find that you could be absolutely peaceful with your body kind of just zooming up and down, just to, you know, because it needs to kind of raise the energy and you know, arouse that vigor. But the heart is completely peaceful. It's just the mind is going nowhere, and there's this body moving. It's interesting. Joseph Campbell said a number of times that the two great mystical experiences, I mean, this guy is a sort of religious professional. He's a kind of major sort of mystic expert, mysticism, and he says the two great mystical experiences of his life both happened on the running track. He was a kind of Olympic class runner, a half miler, and he was of an age where he kind of felt he peaked between two Olympics. So he was a kind of, he ran in the national classes, but he never competed in actually the Olympics. But he said there was this one race, I think he was at Princeton or Columbia, and he was the anchor man in the half mile relay. And so he was the last one to get the baton, and the guy from the other team was like 40 yards in front of him, which even in a half mile is quite a distance to catch up. And he said, and he got the baton in his hand, and he knew he'd won the race. Mm-hmm. And then he just went into this kind of this mystical state, and this sort of altered state. And he was completely still inside. He went absolutely still. And then he was the race happened. And he didn't know how he did it, but there was this kind of beatific experience, and the body just ran, and he won. And it was the most kind of peaceful and delightful experience. I mean, so when he got over the finishing line and everyone was going berserk, cheering him, he just kind of, you know, he just seemed like the most normal thing in the world. He was quite, he wasn't kind of overexcited or kind of ecstatic at his victory. It was just, well, the winning happened. Yeah, this is great. This is delicious, and I'm not kind of carried away by it. So, like in any kind of act of creation, whenever we're trying to do anything, then as we begin to sort of sensitize ourselves or find that, you know, any kind of work that we do, and we all do different kinds of work, whether, you know, the job that we do that we get paid for, or whether it's, you know, you can call it hoovering, vacuuming the carpet. We hoover carpets in England. We're weird. So. You know, whether you're vacuuming the carpet or driving your car or practicing meditation or whatever, or writing a book, then it's like as we begin to find that at whatever work we do, then the more we can say discern the difference between that sort of obsessive compulsive doingness and the energy which comes out of emptiness, the more that we can discern the difference and we incline towards the latter. And then we just letting the work happen. Then we find that the whole way in which we work and the results of it are much more beautiful. I mean, you can tell the difference between, you know, when you've done something, any kind of work or job that you've done, the difference between when you've done it from a place of clarity and brightness, emptiness, the results of it are very, very different than when you've done it from a place of compulsion. You know, it's like when you see a work of art that has you look at it and you realize someone's figured this out. this is a calculation. I remember reading a book review about a collection of poems, fairy tale, a romance even, a Buddhist romance. Well, there's the thing. And I won't tell you what happens. But it's a work that it was written in 1906 by a Danish guy, and anyway, this I'm working on at the moment, and re-editing it and putting it into more readable English, and it's a really interesting process because you get to a sentence, and also there's a lot of notes and references and commentary that goes along with it as well, and then you hit a sentence, and then you ask yourself, well, no, that's not right. You know it's not right, but you don't know what is right. And then you start trying to figure it out, and then it gets even more of a tangle. And then I find if I'm just going to sit back and lean back in the chair and say, well, what do I actually want to say here? And you just let go of it. You're still focused on it, but you let go of it. And then it's almost like you hear it. It's a really interesting process because it's almost like I'm actually hearing the words of what I want to say. But, oh, right. In it goes. It's like I didn't think it, or I didn't write it. It was more like I heard it. And that's how it's experienced when we're kind of much more responsive to life. And then what comes out at the end is like, oh, look at that. Mm-hmm. When we bring that kind of heart. So I was telling one of the Anagarikas this story of another Japanese story. Again, I don't know whether it's true, but it's supposed to be true. This is about a man who was a famous cook. The kind of vice abbot is the cook in the Zen monasteries. And this particular monk was extremely famous for his cooking abilities. And one day the samurai shows up, who obviously liked his food. Substantial samurai. And says, you know, I hear you're the best cook in Japan. Well, you know, my name is General so-and-so. And obviously indicating that, you know, I am an important figure. And, okay. If you're the best cook in Japan, cook me the best food that you can, and I'll see if what they say is true. So the monk goes off and disappears into the kitchen, and the samurai is kind of sitting there in the reception room, waiting. And an hour goes by, and there's this sort of clattering noises and little kind of shufflings and going on in the kitchen. And an hour and a half goes by, you know, starting to rumble, oh, he must be ready soon. Another hour goes by. Not ready yet? Shuffle, shuffle, shuffle. Another hour goes by. 3.5 hours. Well, it must be something really, really incredible that he's brewing up in there. I mean, it's a really long time to be cooking. He waits a bit longer, and he thinks, and he's sort of shuttling between the feeling that this is either going to be the most incredible meal that's ever been cooked, it's the most fantastic array of specialist dishes that he's putting together. It's this kind of hot expectation, or this rage for like me, the big general who is being kept, nobody keeps me waiting. You know, people lose their heads for less. I am not one who waits. And so he's kind of shuttling between this intense kind of aversion, irritation, and this excitement for delicious food. And then finally, you know, this has got a big build-up. Another hour goes by, and finally after 4.5 hours, you know, the door opens. And in comes the monk with this little tray with two pots and an empty bowl on it. you know, big pot and small pot. And the samurai is kind of, because he's supposed to have a lot of composure, right? So, but the brow is kind of lower, the furrow. And he says, and so the monk kind of comes in and then puts the tray down on the table and sits there, and then the samurai thinks he's not going back for any other trays. So he kind of keeps his straight face, and then the monk kind of takes the lid off the big pot, and in it there's brown rice. So he takes a little bowl, takes a spoon of rice out, and then puts it down, puts the lid on the rice pot, takes a small dish, and then takes the lid off that. Inside there's grated radish. Now, boiled rice and grated radish is something that a three-year-old could prepare, right? So he takes this, it's not even cooked radish, just grated. So he takes some of this grated radish, and he takes it, and he sprinkles it on top of the brown rice, and then offers it to the samurai. And this is like, control is lost at this point. And this samurai general kind of erupts and says, you know, this is outrageous, this is appalling, you know, I've come hundreds of miles. Do you realize who I am? You know, I'm one of the most important, powerful people in this country, and I have and also you should know that I have a reputation for a very short temper, and I've beheaded people for far less than this. Now, what is the meaning of this? You know, you kept me waiting 4.5 hours, and you're supposed to be the best cook in Japan, and you just offer me rice and radish. And this is just a blatant insult. And if you don't have a very good excuse, you will lose your head. So the monk says, "Well, would you like to taste it?" So he's, okay. So he picks it up and gets his chopsticks and takes a mouthful. And first of all he can taste is his rage. And then, so the taste hardly registers. And then he takes another mouthful and goes, And very soon, the whole lot's gone. And then, and he finishes this bowl of food. He says, "This is amazing. This is the most. This is what was in that." He says, "This is rice and radish." He says, no, you put something else in it. This is the most amazing food I've ever had. He says, "I never had it. Food quite so kind of beautiful and delicious and something incredible about it. What is it that you put in it?" And he said, "It is just rice and radish. But since you asked me to cook the very best food that I could, I had to do 4 lots of rice before I got it right. And it took me 15 radishes until I grated the entire radish with perfect love and perfect mindfulness. So until I had got that right, I couldn't possibly serve you, because you'd said that, you know, you wanted the very best that I could offer. So this is what it took." I like that story. So I have talked for long enough, and so if we have a little time for a question or two, if people would like, then yes.
How does equanimity fit into what you've been speaking of tonight, goal directedness and zeal and such?
Well, equanimity is what you apply when the universe will not go along with your wishes. So it's like it's almost like the context for the world of action. When you direct your attention towards the fan and you say stop, and then it won't stop. It's like when you are. That's the fundamental attitude, is that everything is okay, and then the action takes place within that context. So that then, well, if the fan stops, then that's good. If the fan doesn't stop, then you realize, I have to do something about this switch. But not tonight. Some other time.
I was thinking, like, an example you gave of you do something nice for a person and they really are appreciative of that, but you don't just toss it off and say, oh, it's nothing. You make a mess of breakfast.
Mm.
You recognize it's a mess. It's hard to be, how do you feel and have a fine community to that? Should you apply it for that?
Well, it's a difference between that kind of, what I'm talking about, like a sort of false equanimity, you know, where you're kind of using an idea of, oh, well, it's all the same. Nothing really makes a difference. And you're kind of overriding your feelings of, oh God, I made a mess. Or, hey, they really love me. Oh, I really did something good, and this person's appreciating, actually receiving their love. You're kind of taking an idea of everything, you know, it's all empty and of no value. And so you're kind of just painting everything over with this sort of grey wash and calling it equanimity. But it's just, that's really just coming from our brain or a kind of an idea. The real equanimity is, the word is probably better translated as serenity. So it's like that in us which doesn't wobble. So it's more to do with whether we are, we meet with great success or great failure, great and ecstatic pleasure or great pain, then there's that in us which is not wobbling, which is kind of unshaken by that, which is serene, which is attuned. It's absolutely attuned to the world around us, but it's that place of perfect stillness, if you like. So it's still an emotional quality, like of the what they call the Brahma Viharas. Upekha is the last, and of all, many of the lists, Upekha is the last of them. Like serenity is the final word of all teachings, is the Buddhist saying. So like in the list of the 10, here we go, the list again. The 10 paramitas, the 10 spiritual qualities, Upekha is the last one. In the list of the factors of enlightenment, Upekha is the last one. In the four Brahma Viharas, Upekha is the last one. Because it's like, in terms of the emotional quality, it's closest to the fundamental nature of mind itself. It's still in the world of action and relationship. It's a conditioned dharma, if you like. But it's kind of, it's close to the border of the unconditioned, where that is that kind of unshakable quality. There was two nuns who came to visit in January this year, Sister Upekha and Sister Vayama. Upekha is one of the most energetic people I've ever met, and Sister Vayama is one of the most equanimous people I've ever met. Vayama means effort, right? So Sister Effort was the the serene one, and Sister Serenity was the energetic one.
Tanha. When one gets caught in tanha, it's hard to remember to reflect or to go back and to feel in the body or the sensations or what it feels like, because tanha has taken over and greed is already an attachment and all the other lovelies have already happened. So how does one pull back a little bit from tanha, you know, when one is involved with it, the grasping?
Well, that's the whole point of spiritual training, is that you're training yourself to catch the process earlier and earlier on. So a lot of the time, you're past the tanha, you're on to kind of grasping, and you're kind of like Wile E. Coyote, you know, three steps over the cliff. That, you know, it's kind of, oops. Down you go. So It's that moment when he looks back and realizes, oops, you know, there's six foot of space. So it's like capitalizing on those moments and realizing, oh, look where I've got myself, and then splat. And so that you remember the painfulness of the splats, and so that you are able to catch that earlier and earlier, so that you make a point of learning, like, okay, well, that's the last time I was in this situation, this is where it got me. This is where, you know, this is where it took me to, okay, remember this. And even if you forget it the next time, it's like, oh God, I forgot it. And so you start again, you make more, so each time that you kind of get mushed, then it slowly becomes more and more, and in recognizing that, the kind of folly of that, then it's like you're creating the conditions whereby you can see the whole process sooner and sooner. So that then as soon as you might think, oh God, I just get totally carried away by desire. But if you compare yourself to the way you were 5 years ago or 10 years ago, you know, now I can guarantee that you catch it like when you're only like 5% as far in. And what you now register as, oh my God, I'm overwhelmed by desire. It's just like, you know, you walked past the cake shop and thought, ooh. 10 years ago, you would have bought the cake shop. You know. And then, but the way we register it, it's like, you know, you catch it with a much kind of lighter signal. You know, the mind gets more and more refined. And emotionally it might feel like, oh God, that's so degrading, that's so disgusting. Haven't I got over this yet? And in fact, all you thought was, oh, that looks interesting. You know, it's not that flagrant, you know. It's not like kind of just breaking the door open and just scarfing cheesecakes. Or, you know, which is a bit extreme, but... you know, what we would have registered as an extreme kind of overindulgence. Now it's like what registers as being coarse or gross is much, much more refined. But we always experience it with this kind of the degree of painfulness, to where even just like the thought of I don't want to be bothered with her. She's a really boring person. Oh God, not her again. And just even the faintest thought of that, you know, like you've been talking to people for 15 hours straight and then someone else arrives and you think, oh no. And then even just a reasonable excuse not to feel that, you know, for that thought to arise. But even just for that thought to arise, you know, oh, that's terrible. What a painful thought. Which, you know, it's registered as painful as like before you started, you know, really working on yourself, like you would have just said to their face, I can't stand you. or I'm sorry, I've got another appointment. Just even when you weren't the slightest bit needing to be anywhere else, you could have taken the trouble to be with them and engage with them. So, I mean, the problem is that, you know, ignorance is inherently blinding. Yeah. And so that you have to feed the painful results of following craving and negativity. You have to feed those results back in to kind of inform your actions for the future. Yeah.
Is there a Buddhist definition of self? Is there a self?
That was the question the Buddha refused to answer. The way the Buddha approached it was by saying, what is not self? That there's no... Because, say with... If we try and make metaphysical definitions, like definitions in language of things which inherently go beyond language, we've got to miss the mark. So what the way the Buddha approached it, which is very ingenious really, is through a process of elimination. So by looking at your body, by looking at your feelings, your sensations, by looking at the perceptions you experience, by looking at thoughts and emotions and moods, different states of consciousness, and by looking at those, reflecting on them, examining them, and kind of coming to a direct knowledge that, you know, this is not myself, this is not me, this is not what I am, this does not belong to me. There is no owner of this body, of these thoughts, of these feelings, perceptions. And that the notion of an owner or an experiencer or an individual agent is an impression that arises because of the weave of experiences. And that when you actually analyze each quality of experience, when you look at the body, then in a direct and reflective way, then there's a realization, well, this is not me, this is not what I am, this is not myself. You know, I can't make the body obey my wishes. I can't say, don't get sick or don't grow old. I can't make it be the way I want it to be, etc. And so the Buddha kind of goes, teaches these different patterns of reflection and contemplation about the body and the aspects of mind. And then through a process of elimination, you know, you arrive at this, well, I'm not the body, I'm not thoughts, I'm not emotions, I'm not feelings, I'm not memories. And that by letting go of what you're not, then by a process of elimination, then what you are, if you like, is revealed. But you can't define what that isness is. You know? And so that the Buddha never attempted to, and said that you're going to lead yourself down the wrong track. Better to, as soon as we let go of what we're not, then the reality of what is becomes apparent. And whether you call that the self or the universe or ultimate reality or limitless, timeless space point zero, or your divine nature, or Like Ajahn Sumedho once said, that you can call it Montgomery, you can call it Montague if you like. So one of his more kind of expansive moments. It doesn't matter what you call it. You know, it's because it's the realization of that nature, which is the important thing. And then to say, ah, this is myself. And then, you know, you've, or this is my true self. Then you start to get into the kind of philosophical tangles. Like, well, is this the not self seeing the true self? Or is this the not self seeing the false self? Or is this the true self seeing the not self? Or, you know, and you just end up in a kind of metaphysical tangle. So that the point is always like that direct realization rather than forming a concept about. And then the concept can line up. You can call it God, you can call it emptiness, you can call it Ishmael or Montague or Christina, you know, whatever you like. That the formulation is immaterial, because that the actual reality itself is the thing that is of significance.